History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that ought to be told. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, and so often we really are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I am absolutely confident that'll be the case today in Watsonville, California, with 96-year-old, soon to be 97-year-old, Don Cooley, who served in the 106th Infantry Division in World War II, spent much of the end of World War II as a prisoner of war, and he's got quite a story to share today. But Don, let's go way back, long before you ever tasted these beautiful California sunsets here from your deck in Watsonville. West Lafayette, Indiana, growing up with a brother and three sisters. What do you remember about that childhood?
Well, I remember that it was during the Depression. I had a paper route and raised rabbits, and that's about it.
Your father was a professor at Purdue University?
Yes.
What did he teach?
He was in the Agricultural School of Animal Husbandry.
So I guess if you had any trouble raising those rabbits, he could set you straight?
That's true. That's true. And you know what rabbits do? They keep you busy.
It's not exactly how I heard it. And you mentioned the Depression. And for us today, most of us were not alive for World War II, let alone the Great Depression. How can you help us understand what life was really like and how different and difficult things were?
I can't really tell you how difficult things were in the country because I lived in a small university community with a town of 5,000 and the city of Lafayette across the river at 30,000, and our school was all made up of university kids, and my father kept his job. The university staff had a 10% reduction in salary, but I wasn't aware of people being laid off.
And how about your siblings? How did they treat you? Your brother was 7 years older, did you say?
Yes, and he was a big brother, and I learned from him to be a hustler. He sold pansies from a nearby nursery, and I had a paper route and other activities of that nature.
Did you have an idea in those early years of, hey, someday when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do or this is who I'm going to be?
I don't think so. Well, I was motivated by some books I found in my father's bookshelf, particularly one by leaders of American industry. Actually, one that influenced me there was a man in 1935 who was among the highest paid executives in the United States, Thomas J. Watson, the chairman of IBM. And the reason I mention that is of what you'll find out later about my career.
All right. You're teasing it for us. I don't have to be the one who's throwing the tease out there. So leading up to World War II, there's war in Europe, there's war in Asia, but war hasn't come to the United States yet. And you graduate high school and started at Purdue?
Well, yes, I graduated from high school right after Pearl Harbor. I thought, uh-oh, my brother's going to get caught in this thing. Well, I got a surprise.
And since you mentioned Pearl Harbor, what do you remember about that day?
I remember that we were sitting around the radio on Sunday evening, listening to Jack Benny probably, and the news came. And being in the middle of the country, it didn't register as heavily as, I must say, many years later when I married a girl who grew up here near Watsonville, where there was real concern about the Japanese who had to be moved out. And so I guess that's jumping too far ahead to your question.
Well, no, but that's perspective. So people who lived where you're sitting right now, it was a very different experience. And there was fear that the Japanese were going to invade California. The Japanese Americans here farming so much of this land were rounded up and sent inland. So that's a real part of the story that I guess you guys in the Midwest at the time were kind of insulated from.
Correct.
So back to your story, you start at Purdue. And are you thinking that at some point you're going to get into the military?
Well, it was clear then. I graduated from high school the spring after Pearl Harbor that I probably will. And so the draft got closer and closer, so that the fall of my freshman year, I decided I'd better snap up this thing they call the Enlisted Reserve Corps, which said you could remain in school. They didn't say for how long. And it wasn't long. It was just freshman year.
And then along came something called the ASTP, and you became part of that. Tell us about that.
Well, that was great, because the first thing they did was to send us to infantry basing camp to learn how to be a soldier, because the invasion in Europe was coming up, and I think they needed bodies. But ASTP, Army Specialized Training Program, was open for most of us, a lot of us who had been in college the previous year. So off to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, we went to the university. Well, all the men had been taken away too, so it was just a university full of beautiful women.
Did you have any idea how long they would let you continue going to school, or was it a rude awakening for you when they said, hey, no more ASTP, you're going overseas?
The latter.
Yeah.
Only not directly overseas. We were assigned to an infantry division that had just come off Tennessee maneuvers to Camp Atterbury, Indiana, where they put together the 106th Division for training for the next 7 months. I took to it enthusiastically. We were in an ammunition and pioneer platoon of a headquarters company, and that had a little different flavor, perhaps, than just a straight infantryman. And a big benefit was that Camp Atterbury, Indiana, was only 100 miles from home, so I could hitchhike home for the weekend.
And when it became clear that this division was going to be sent overseas,
okay, this is what we're in here to do, so let's get it done. Arrived in England about the end of October 1944. We went across the Land of Larve and were trucked right up to the front on December 11th. And what people may not remember, but December 16th, 5 days later, was when the Germans opened up the bulge.
And I've talked to a few guys from your division, the 106th Infantry Division, who said they were told at the time that where you guys were going was a quiet front. Do you remember hearing that?
I certainly do.
And did you believe it?
Well, it was quiet the 4 days we were there. It was quiet.
So you're thinking this is no big deal? We've got this covered? Or what was it like for
well,
you?
Well, it was the heavy winter cold hadn't hit quite yet. We were told it was nice. It was in the Ardennes Forest. It was pretty.
And that's right about the time of your 21st birthday, right?
Well, I was turned 21 while we were in the boxcar halfway across Germany.
Well, we'll get to that, because for now you're still a free man. And let's talk about the division, because there's some unique aspects to the 106th Infantry Division compared to other divisions who fought in Europe.
It was made up of odd lots, R-A-S-T-P. A lot of them. They didn't need as many military police in the U.S. There were cooks and bottle washers, and the 106th was, I'd say, 50% not ones who'd been really trained as infantrymen.
And even though you had been trained, you hadn't experienced combat before, and that was the case for pretty much everyone you were serving with, right?
Well, it certainly was. Do you know why they called that thing the Battle of the Bulge?
Why don't you explain it for us?
Well, you have to visualize the result, and that is the Germans pushed in, and they pushed in right where we were, right in the middle of it. Somehow we got energized, and it was also the forest. So the Germans said, well, why mess around with these? We'll just go around them. And so that they went around us and took 6,000 prisoners from our division and went around us, and they were headed for Antwerp, because that was what the Allies needed so badly to get supplies up. And they made this huge bulge in the battle line and were stopped, fortunately. And that's how it got its name. The press, you know, called it, this is a bulge, and that's what it is.
Yeah, and you said fortunately they were stopped, but that came at a heavy, heavy cost in American lives. And I'm interested in those few days now before your life really changed. So you said you get there at December 11th, the Ardennes Forest. What was your job, or what did you understand your duty to be?
Well, I was a battalion clerk. When we moved up, the battalion commander was in the Siegfried Line. We were at the Siegfried Line, which were these big cement encasements they built after World War I, and it was the headquarters for the battalion. And so my job was working with him and doing the morning report and all that sort of stuff. And so we were moving forward. We advanced forward, but the Germans were there. And in fact, the unit I was in, the immediate group of men, we didn't fire a shot because our regimental commander notified that we were to give up. Break up your rifle. And it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon in December. It gets dark at that. And so the Germans were in such a hurry to come and infiltrate and take us prisoners because of that, I think, that they didn't search us very closely. And I had a baby Brownie camera in my car. How I happened to have that with me at that time, I don't know, but I've got that yet, and I'll show it to you.
Well, and some of the pictures that camera took, you still have. They're incredibly well preserved, and we'll put some of those up at hometownheroesradio.com. But I'm trying to understand what it must have been like for you. You're not quite to your 21st birthday. It's just a couple weeks before Christmas. You haven't even experienced combat yet, and you're being told before you guys even put up a fight, you have to surrender.
This particular location in the forest, mm-hmm. where we were, yes.
And that was the 423rd Regiment, is that right?
That's correct. So, Headquarters Company, 423rd.
Headquarters Company, 423rd Regiment. So how did that compute in your head? I imagine that had to be kind of hard to swallow or come to grips with.
Oh, we were just PO'd. You know, for gosh sakes, you know, get us, keep moving back through their lines where they had soldiers coming up, some horse-driven vehicles, and here we are, a long chain of prisoners.
And, you know, for those who are hearing this for the first time, maybe they're saying, well, why did they have to surrender? Why did their commanding officers give that order?
They wised up to the fact that they were completely cut off from the 3rd Regiment of our division back at St. Vith. This was agreed. And we were out of communications with some of them. They did it as to save lives.
Because of the positioning of the German troops, had your regiment tried to fight, it would have just resulted in more lives lost, and whoever was left standing would end up prisoners. But there was no hope of breaking out of that and reconnecting the lines.
That's what these regimental commanders decided. In my company was the son of our regimental commander. You can imagine how that make him feel. I think that was a bad mistake for the Army to have a relative under the command of a top general.
So he took the brunt of all the criticism of his father?
He broke down practically. Mm. He was older.
Well, what about you? How did you handle this? Because I'm sure you never anticipated it when you were going overseas.
Well, of course not. We just handled it because it happened, and fortunately there were several of us who were good friends that were together, and so we were all just terribly disappointed. I know that doesn't sound strong enough, but you know, we're young kids.
Well, and now you know, with 75 plus years of hindsight, what the next few months would be like for you. But do you remember at the time trying to figure out what kind of future you were looking forward to?
No, I know. We were just trying to keep dry because it was rainy and the snow was melting that day and feet were probably wet and cold and we were hungry.
And what did the Germans do with you?
They marched us for 2 days. They put on a train that had brought soldiers up to the front. These were boxcars, these 40 and 8. 40 men and 8 horses, I guess is what that came from. And so, 3 or 4 days later, they got us into these trains and locked the doors and started east.
Did you have anything to eat during that time?
Yeah, I think we had, usually it was potato soup. I had kept in the pocket of my big heavy overcoat a D-ration, which is chocolate bars, which is the smallest volume, more energy than anything that we were issued. Not by the Germans, I just had it with me because the last couple of days, we were on foot in the forest and not back in the cement headquarters. Then once we got on the boxcar, my notes would tell when we got food or didn't. But I think each day we got potato soup or something. They opened up and gave us a little and probably poured it into our steel helmets to drink out of, which we had used for other things while sequestered in the boxcar.
And you can probably imagine what some of those might have been. It's break time, but there's much more to come with 96-year-old Don Cooley, including a moment in that cramped boxcar that I'm pretty sure is going to make a powerful impression on you. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook for photos and a short video with Don, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.